This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Emily Blunt stars as Mary Poppins in the new film Mary Poppins Returns, a Disney musical sequel to the beloved 1964 film which starred Julie Andrews and was adapted from the 1934 P.L. Travers novel. Blunt is nominated for a Golden Globe and an award from SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, for her performance. Emily Blunt is known for her roles in The Devil Wears Prada, Looper, Sicario, The Girl on the Train, the film adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, and the horror film A Quiet Place, which was directed by her husband, John Krasinski, who also starred opposite her, playing her husband. In Mary Poppins Returns, the two children she helped raise in the first story, Jane and Michael Banks, are now adults. Michael is a single father, still mourning the loss of his wife a year after her death. His three young children desperately miss their mother. It's Depression-era London, and times are hard. Michael is an artist, unable to support his children with his art, so he's taken a temporary job as a bank teller. But the bank is about to foreclose on the family's home, the same house the bank's children grew up in. The bank's family needs a miracle. And they kind of get one when Mary Poppins comes floating back down from the sky to become the children's new nanny. The adult Jane and Michael are astonished and confused when they see her. Here's Ben Whishaw as Michael, Emily Mortimer as Jane, and Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins!
Close your mouth, please, Michael. We are still not a codfish. Jane Banks. Still rather inclined to giggle, I see.
Good heavens. It really is you.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? How incredibly rude. One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
You came back. I thought we'd never see you again.
It is wonderful to see you.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Emily Blunt, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on Mary Poppins Returns.
Thank you.
I'm going to start by asking you what everybody is asking you, I'm sure. How old were you when you saw the original film and what did it mean to you?
I'm sure it was about 5 or 6, and I think like most of the world, it was probably one of the first films that I ever saw and was spellbound by it. And I remember elements of it so clearly, you know, the Jolly Holiday sequence where I couldn't believe that people could dance with cartoons. You know, it was like incredible to me. And most profoundly, I remember, maybe because she is a bit of a disciplinarian, the idea of feeling very safe in her hands as a child, that she was going to come in and sweep it all up and make everything right again in a very sure-handed way. And I remember just feeling safe with her, you know, with the groundedness of her, but and the magic.
Did you read the Mary Poppins books?
Well, I didn't as a child, but I did leading up to playing my version of her. In fact, I didn't watch the original again right before I played her. I just chose to, you know, have my, you know, a few memories of it from watching it as a child, but I didn't want to sort of get compromised by the details of what Julie Andrews did so beautifully. I knew it was going to be my version of her, so I did very much dive into the books where she is rather different, sort of rather eccentric and batty and very rude and vain. And so that's that. The books became a very evocative source for this new version of her for me.
Let me read a couple of lines from the original Mary Poppins book. Jane and Michael could see that the newcomer had shiny black hair, rather like a wooden Dutch doll, whispered Jane, and that she was thin, with large feet and hands and small, rather peering blue eyes. You know, people know Just a Spoonful of Sugar, where Mary Poppins sings about how to sweeten the medicine and to help the medicine go down. So in the book, Mary Poppins is holding out medicine and it says, Michael suddenly discovered that you could not look at Mary Poppins and disobey her. There was something strange and extraordinary about her, something that was frightening and at the same time, most exciting. So, you know, you talk about how you took, like, the disciplinarian part of her. You portray her, and she's this way in the book, as so proper and such a disciplinarian. But she has this other magical side. Like every time she's the proper disciplinarian, there's always this implicit or explicit wink that's going on. And I was wondering if you could talk about playing both sides of her character.
Sure. I mean, I think that that's what excited me about her is the duality of her. And certainly when P.L. Travers wrote her, you know, everyone would talk to P.L. Travers about how magical she is and how fantastical she is and how supernatural she is. And she said, well, I don't think she is at all. I think she is reality. I think she's very, very real. And she talks about her. She described her. She just said, in order to fly, you need something very solid to take off from. And I think that's how I see her. She is practical and yet fantastical and fastidious and yet really eccentric. And she doesn't really reveal her inner workings to anybody. I think she rather likes that she's a mystery. She takes a lot of joy in that no one can figure her out.
And every time a magical episode is over, in the books, Mary Poppins denies that it ever happened.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's the form of true generosity, to give so much and to recognize what people need and give it to them and expect absolutely nothing in return, in fact, to not even take credit for it. And I think maybe for me with the character, she connects so deeply. She's all about that, about connectivity with people. But yet she holds at arm's length. And I've always felt personally it's because she will inevitably have to leave. It's maybe her way of coping with that.
You play that at the end. I mean, I could see the sadness on your face. When
she loves the banks.
Yeah,
I think it's
very
hard.
Yeah, and she's alone in the sky. I mean, she doesn't have a family.
She is.
And she's never going to, I don't think.
No.
So because
I think she likes flirting around with many laborers, but I don't think she has a special man in her life, you know.
You know, because she is so proper, you know, she has a very proper accent, and it's not the accent that you're speaking to us with now.
No.
Did you have to learn the Mary Poppins proper accent for the part?
I mean, it's not that I had to sort of do dialect lessons, you know. I mean, I can do various different accents from England, you know. It just makes me laugh that Mary Poppins is even posher than my mother, which I can't quite believe, you know.
But, is your mother posh?
She is very posh, yes. So is my dad. You know, they speak beautifully. But I think for Mary Poppins, it needed to be a pretty exaggerated version of that because of her imperious nature. But also she should sound practically perfect. And also it's set in the 30s, which was a very specific sound. And so funnily enough, I listened to Princess Margaret quite a lot for how she spoke. And then I just sort of winged it.
Can you say a few words with that proper accent? Can you answer the next question with that accent? Here's one
sure.
that would set you up perfectly. There's, you know, several Mary Poppins-isms. And one of them is, now spit spot into bed.
Well, Terry, my absolute favorite would have to be Pish Posh. I just think it's a wonderful way of just shutting everything down.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Now, are those real Britishisms, Spit Spot and Pish Posh? Or are those like Mary Poppins expressions?
I think they are. I mean, I think that P.L. Travers actually heard her auntie say Spit Spot and off to bed. So I think she took it from that. But I think they have quickly... I don't think I ever heard anyone say Pish Posh until I read the Mary Poppins books. It is my favorite phrase that she has, is Pish Posh.
So what was floating down from the sky like for you?
Well, quite terrifying, I think. I mean, I thought I was all right with heights. And then as they winch you past 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet, you're suddenly at 60 feet. And you realize you're terrible with heights. And Lin-Manuel Miranda was like the size of a pea suddenly. and I found the easiest thing to do when I was that high was just to look upwards to the sky, because then I had no frame of reference for just how high I was, because I was at that point above the trees and Lin was tiny. And I thought for a second, this might be how I go. This is how I go, dressed as Mary Poppins.
Oh, no. Were you really thinking that?
Yeah, because it's just one wire. And you're thinking, well, who's holding the wire? And do I know them even? And you know, it's just you literally have your life in a burly stuntman's hands.
Now, silly me, I was imagining that it was kind of some kind of rear projection and that you didn't have to float that much.
No. I mean, Rob Marshall, the director, very much wanted to do everything as practically as possible. So as much as possible, it was us in the air on wires. And I don't think I was alone. I think a few of my co-stars were quite scared of heights as well.
And you were wearing high heels.
Yes, exactly.
Like if you had a crash that would not have been good.
Yes. No, not good. I mean, that was one of the scariest stunts we did. We're doing this fantastic number through the streets of London that Lin-Manuel Miranda has. It's a huge show-stopping Hollywood number called Trip a Little Light Fantastic. And we have to dance along the top of a narrow wall and then jump off the wall out of shot. And we land on a crash mat. But you're wearing heels. And so I thought, well... And my stunt woman tried it for me first and twisted her ankle.
Oh,
I think
gosh.
She was in a boot for the rest of the shoot. So, yeah, it was just all Mission Impossible doing Mary Poppins, you see.
But you did the stunt anyway?
I did do it, but only a couple of times. And then I said, Rob, I think I don't want to do it anymore.
Let's hear you sing. You know, I heard you sing first in the film adaptation of Into the Woods, the Stephen Sondheim mm-hmm. musical, which was adapted for the screen by Rob Marshall, who also yes. directed Mary Poppins Returns. And he's so good with musicals. I mean, he also did Chicago.
He's extraordinary. I mean, I think he is the only man for this impossible job of taking on the next chapter of Mary Poppins.
Yeah, it's very hard to do musicals on film, I think.
It's
somehow easier on stage. I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe because stage, there's nothing, it's not realism, whereas in movies, you're kind of expected to see some sort of realism, though that's not even true since there's so many superheroes and sci-fi and everything.
You're exactly right. But I think the thing about film is that everything gets terribly intimate and you are sucked into a world that has a sense of realism. You're not in that proscenium arch nature of watching a performance on stage. And I think that's his great skill, is making sure that it's not sort of embarrassing when people break into song. It can very often be like, oh God, why are they singing, you know?
Well, in this film, he really has a knack. He and the composer Mark Shaiman and the lyricist Scott Whitman for kind of talking into songs. So like
Absolutely.
You talk your way into the songs. The character of Michael, the father, talks his way into his
yes.
song. And we're going to hear an example of that in the song I'm going to play. It is a song I really like. It's called Can You Imagine That? And this is it's like your first day with the kids. They've been they're all really dirty and you're preparing a bath. None of them want to take a bath. But you put these like magic bubbles in the bath and then you're taking out, you know, all these magical things, all these magical toys from your famous carpet bag.
Yes.
Throwing them into the tub and then even more magic happens. But anyways, as you're doing all of this, you're singing this song, Can You Imagine That, as you're talking to the kids. So here's my guest, Emily Blunt, from the soundtrack of Mary Poppins Returns.
John, you're right. It's good to know you're bright. For intellect can wash away confusion. Georgie sees and Annabelle agrees. Most folderols an optical illusion. You three know it's true that 1 + 1 = 2. Yes, logic is the rock of our foundation. I suspect, and I'm never incorrect, that you're far too old to give in to imagination.
No, not yet.
Some people like to splash and play. Can you imagine that? And take a seaside holiday. Can you imagine that? Too much glee leaves rings around the brain. Take that joy and send it down the drain. Some people like to laugh at life and giggle through the day. They think the world's a brand new shiny toy. And if while dreaming in the clouds they fall and go kasplat, although they're down and bent in half, they brush right off and start to laugh. Can you imagine that?
So that's my guest, Emily Blunt, from the soundtrack of Mary Poppins Returns. So, as I said, you'd already sung in Into the Woods, and Rob Marshall has said that he likes to work with actors who can sing as opposed to singers who can act. And
yes.
I know he's hired voice teachers, like for Chicago, he had a voice coach working with the actors who didn't know how to sing or hadn't at least sung in front of a camera or on stage. Did you get any kind of singing coaching for this role?
Yes. Yes, I mean, I worked with Eric Vitro on Into the Woods, and then I worked with Joan Leder and Eric Vitro on Mary Poppins. And it's sort of essential, actually, for me, because I have not been trained as a singer, and they do give you the sort of confidence and the tools to assist you. I mean, I think it was easier for me with Mary Poppins. I mean, Stephen Sondheim, his music sort of requires all of you. It is some of the most, it is the deep end of musical theatre. But Mary Poppins, for me, was a more slow burn, tailor-made experience because the songs were written with me in mind, with my abilities in mind. And the songwriters and composers, they really learnt my voice and what I could do and what I couldn't do. And so by the time I started singing them on set, I mean, I'd been working with this music for, you know, over a year by that point.
So you were cast before the songs were written?
Yes, yes.
So what did you learn about your voice or about singing for this film that you didn't
already
know? That
I got better. That I had a better range than I thought, probably. I mean, that I think it can, you know, that I shouldn't be intimidated right off the bat with a song because you can improve so much the more you sing it, and it just gets in your blood. And then the other thing, great thing I've learned from working with Rob Marshall, I remember this when I auditioned for Into the Woods, which I went into that room, my knees knocking. I just have always loathed singing in front of people. I really like doing it privately, but just not in front of people. And I went in to audition and I said, Rob, I'm very, very nervous. I said, I don't like singing in front of people. And as you say, he said, I'm not interested in singers who can kind of act. I want actors who can kind of sing. And he said, so I just want you to tell me a story and stop worrying about making it sound pretty, but tell me your story as this character. And that's, I think, what I learned is that I think the singers that we all respond to and fall in love with are the ones that evoke a story and the ones that make you feel something. It's not just about listening to vocal gymnastics. It's about telling a story that moves people. So that's sort of what I tend to focus on now and not worry about how it sounds. And it always sounds better if I stop worrying about how it sounds.
So when you were a child, you had a stutter. How bad
Yes.
was it, and how did it affect your childhood?
It was very bad. It got progressively worse. It was not so bad when I was younger. By the time I was sort of 12, 13, it was probably at its peak. And it is, and it was, and still is for many people who suffer with it. It is a condition that people sort of tease because you sound funny and you look funny when you stutter. You're trying to force words out so everything contorts and you can sometimes look like a crazy person, you know, and it's a misrepresentation of who you are. It's just an inability to speak. And so I work a lot with kids who stutter and adults who stutter. And it's hard when you're in the thick of it because you think it's going to be your whole life. And it's not. It doesn't have to be. If you get the right treatment, it's very temporary. You can very much manage it. You just need to get the right help. But it did affect me. I mean, I did become less verbose, literally, and didn't want to speak as much just because I was embarrassed. But I was also embarrassed for people who were talking to me because they don't know what to do. Some people would just be, I had this awful teacher who just said, just say it, just spit it out. You know, people don't understand it. They don't understand why you can't speak. Kids don't understand why you can't speak. And there's not enough information out there about it. And it's very common.
So you said it got worse. Until you were like 12 or 13, why do you think it got
Yes.
worse with time instead of better until that point?
Well, I think it's a skipping record. And then as soon as you associate yourself with somebody who stutters and that's the stamp that you put on yourself, then it sort of solidifies it in some ways. But then I did grow out of mine. And I think a lot of it was to do with this extraordinary teacher I had who encouraged me to do a class play. And I said, I don't want to. And he said, I think you're very funny. And I think that you are very good at voices. You do silly voices and you don't stutter when you do a silly voice. So why don't you do a silly accent or something? That's probably why I've always been really fascinated by changing my voice depending on the role. And because it was a way of unlocking me And I have to credit him as somebody who's not a stutterer for understanding that idea of sort of removing yourself from yourself so that you can speak fluently. And it was one of the first times doing a stupid Northern English accent that I could speak fluently.
So with Mary Poppins Returns, your new film, have you seen it with an audience?
I have seen it once with an audience, and I thought it was just an overwhelmingly wonderful experience, actually, because you sort of rediscover it through their eyes, and the energy and the joy in the room was palpable and terribly exciting.
You know, it's funny, like for me, I was just like a few years too old to see it as a child. So, mm-hmm. and I was at that age where, like, you've just become not a child anymore. Like, I was maybe, did it come out in 1964, the original?
Yes, it did, yeah.
So I would have been 12 or 13.
Sure.
And, like, you don't want to be associated with child things at that age. It's like, no, I'm an adult now. You know. And I was just a little too old to want to hear songs like Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious or Just a Spoonful of Sugar. And so I don't have those childhood associations with the movie.
So I'm your first Mary Poppins?
You kind of are. I've seen, like, last week I watched some of the original, but
yeah.
I have no, like, emotional childhood
sure.
connection with it. But I yeah. really like your film so much.
Thank you.
So I'm really curious what people seeing it without any preconceptions will think, because that's kind of where
well,
I was.
I personally have found that even if people have not seen the original, I think they're still terribly moved by this version, and they don't really know why. I think probably the general nostalgic feeling and the spirit of the film represents how people grew up and the kind of films they probably watched growing up. And then there are a lot of people who are diehard fans of the original, and I quite like people like that going into our film, because I think they go into it with their arms crossed, sort of wanting to hate it, and they end up really loving it. And I had this one journalist say to me the other day, who's quite a cynical guy, he just said, I honestly went in not wanting to like it at all. I don't like musicals, and I really liked the original as a child, but I don't like watching musicals. And he said, but when I saw you coming out of the clouds, I just started to sob, and I don't know why. That's so awesome for me to hear that. It's just, I kind of like both. I like people who are diehard fans, and I like people who've never seen it before.
Emily Blunt, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so
you
much.
You too. Well, thank you very much. I love talking to you.
Emily Blunt stars as Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins Returns. Every year, pop music artists release new albums of Christmas music. Some of them cover familiar holiday songs, others write new material for the season. Rock critic Ken Tucker listened to a big batch of new releases and winnowed his pile down to two: Rodney Crowell's Christmas Everywhere and The Monkees' Christmas Party. Here's Ken's review.
Christmas, 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 Christmas everywhere. Christmas, 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 pulling out my hair. Shoppers lined up out the door, traffic backed up miles or more. It's Christmas time, so what the heck? Let's go spend the whole paycheck. Christmas.
It's that time of year when people you didn't expect start releasing Christmas albums. First on my list is Rodney Crowell, the veteran singer-songwriter who freely admits he never considered putting out a Christmas album until now. Crowell has described himself as having gone sour on Christmas, just due to his own moody nature. But recently, his attitude changed for a variety of reasons, among them grandchildren whose own joy in making Christmas music warmed his ornery old heart. I like the way he sets melancholy to a jaunty beat on Christmas Makes Me Sad.
Christmas makes me sad.
Christmas makes me sad.
Christmas makes me blue.
Christmas makes me blue.
Christmas makes me lonely without you. I wander down these city streets. It seems like everyone I meet is happy, 'cause it's Christmas time. But something else hangs on my mind. The sights and sounds around this old town says it's that time of year, but you're not here, and
and I'll spend my silent night alone.
Crowell approaches Christmas through some interesting, eccentric directions. The cheerful song that opened this review, called Christmas Everywhere, includes a very odd interlude two-thirds of the way through, in which a child asks Santa for a time machine in which to go back and prevent John Lennon's murder. On another song, Christmas Inviter, Crowell invites the author Mary Carr to yowl along with him. Co-writing, they create a vividly bleak holiday scenario in the town of Vider, Texas.
I won't build no snowman, won't drink no nog, just wander around in a bayou fog.
Take out the turkey, lay down the grub, fix my face, do the dishes, throw the kids in the tub.
Spend the late night standing inside the fridge door, bathe in the green light and hungry for more.
Back door's wide open, here's what I know. The end of that driveway is as far as I'll go.
It's Christmas Inviter,
88 degrees.
It's Christmas Inviter,
oh Jesus, please.
It's Christmas Inviter,
leave me alone.
Let's shake off that holiday dolorousness with a new Monkees album titled Christmas Party. Yes, the Monkees, three-quarters of whom are still alive and playful. Mickey Dolenz tackles a wide variety of holiday songs here. The album has one track from Peter Tork and two tracks from Mike Nesmith that sound as though they were recorded in brooding isolation. The collection also features two tracks that include vocals by fourth Monkey Davy Jones, who died in 2012. It is, in other words, something of a jerry-rigged Monkees album. But I'll be darned if the whole thing doesn't come together in an entertaining way.
Christmas, you are the gift for me. I can't wait to unwrap you at Christmas under the Christmas tree. I can't wait to unwrap you at Christmas, dream of nothing more. So dear Santa, when you've read my letter, please drop her at my door.
That's Unwrap You at Christmas, written by XTC's Andy Partridge, presumably not in a pear tree. This Monkees album has been primarily produced by Adam Schlesinger, who knows from good pop rock music as half of Fountains of Wayne. Turns out, Schlesinger also wrote the best song on this album, or rather, co-wrote it, with none other than famous novelist Michael Chabon. The tune is called House of Broken Gingerbread, and it's a musical stocking filled with verbal goodies, such as a reference to, quote, one of those French cakes disguised as a log. This song is its own Bouche de Noël of melancholy bliss.
Two mountains of presents, two glittering trees, both frosted in tinsel and blue LEDs, two platters of cookies and peppermint bark, two baby messiahs aglow in the dark. And two sets of clue. There's double the Christmas, but I'm torn in the house of broken gingerbread, butterscotch and candy cigarettes, sugar snow on the flower bed. At the house of broken gingerbread.
For both Rodney Crowell and the Monkees, Christmas is a time for taking stock, of drawing up a gratitude list, and placing the year in perspective. The results aren't always jolly, but they're certainly sincere and passionate.
Ken Tucker reviewed Rodney Crowell's Christmas Everywhere and the Monkees' Christmas Party. Coming up, we talk with actor Lucas Hedges. He's currently starring in the films Ben is Back and Boy Erased. He co-starred in Lady Bird and Manchester by the Sea. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lucas Hedges, was still a teenager when he was nominated for an Oscar for his supporting role in the 2016 movie Manchester by the Sea. He played a 16-year-old who loses his bearings after his father dies and names the boy's uncle as his guardian. Last year, in Greta Gerwig's film Lady Bird, Hedges played a teenager who realizes he's gay and is afraid to tell anyone. Now at the age of 21, Hedges is in three new movies. In mid-90s, he plays a teenager who brutally bullies his younger brother. In Boy Erased, for which he's nominated for a Best Actor Golden Globe, he plays a teenager whose parents send him off to Christian gay conversion therapy. His third new movie, Ben Is Back, was written and directed by his father, Peter Hedges. Lucas Hedges stars as a 19-year-old who's in rehab for an addiction to painkillers and heroin. When he stuns his parents and siblings by showing up unannounced on Christmas Eve, they're worried this means trouble for him and for the whole family. He says he's gotten permission to leave the rehab facility for the holiday, but it's hard for the family and for us in the audience to know when he's telling the truth. At one point, he tells his mother she needs to take him to a 12-step meeting right away. Here he is at the meeting.
Hi, I'm Ben, and I'm an addict. I got 77 days. And that's my most ever. So I just want to get to 78 right now. So I call my sponsor, and the thing about my sponsor is that he's a loud talker. And so I say, hey, and he goes, what's up? And I was like, well, I got big news. I just bought presents that I actually picked out for someone. And he was like, oh, well, you're feeling pretty good, huh? I was like, yeah, you know, I actually feel like I'm being honest. Yeah. And well, he said, if you were honest, Ben, you'd look in the mirror and say I'm a great big phony. So I was like, okay. Because Ben, you're a f-ing addict, and you're the last person who should believe his own bullshit, so now get to a meeting. So here I am, 77 days clean. Some things are better now. Like I can actually take a shit.
Lucas Hedges, welcome to Fresh Air. So your father, Peter Hedges, wrote and directed Ben Is Back. And I'm going to quote something he said. He said that the screenplay was inspired by drug problems in the family. He said, quote, I come from a family that has been deeply impacted by addiction, both alcohol and drugs. Some in my family recovered, some didn't make it, and some family members are still struggling. So after I suffered the loss of someone close to me and watched another person I knew in recovery, I wanted to make a film that explores how one broken, hurting person can impact all the members of his family. Mm. So I don't want to pry or go beyond what's comfortable to talk about, but were these like family addiction problems, problems you were aware of and observed yourself as a child? I don't know how distant in the family tree these problems are.
Yeah. My grandmother was an alcoholic and left my father and his family when he was very young, and it left a very big imprint on his life, and I think he would say it's part of the reason why he's so fascinated with the dynamic between a mother and a child, and is something he really explores in everything he does. And so I was aware of that relationship from a young age. I was also aware that my grandmother dedicated probably the last 25 or so years to her of her life to saving other people in recovery, and that she lived a very, very hard life, but that there was something remarkable. I never really got to know her because she died when I was very young, but there was something really remarkable about how she turned her life around.
So she left the family when your father was young.
Yeah.
Did they reconcile afterwards, after she got sober?
Yeah, it feels as though they reconciled their relationship. I honestly feel like you'd have to ask my dad. I imagine maybe there's something tricky about having a very complicated relationship with your mother and then meeting her 15 years after she sort of abandoned you and your family, and all of a sudden she's this amazing woman. I imagine that's confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never spoken to my dad about this, but that's sort of just what I wonder about, you know.
In Ben Is Back, you play a 19-year-old who has been in and out of rehab, and you've come home for Christmas, surprising your family who think that you really belong in rehab and you probably shouldn't be home, and that it's going to be trouble. And of course, there's plenty of trouble. You've said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but you've said in another interview that you knew people, your peers, who had become addicted to drugs, and you thought it had to do with the fact that they took prescription drugs like Adderall when they were in school. That's one of the drugs for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Do you feel like you've seen like drugs like those damage people, your peers, who were on them?
Well, I was prescribed Adderall, and I took Adderall, and honestly, like, Adderall did not help me do any more work. I took Adderall, and I would end up just sitting on my couch high. It was such an overwhelming experience for me that I couldn't work. And I didn't stop doing it because I enjoyed it. And I never developed an addiction of any kind to that or to any other substance. But I think if you're predisposed to that kind of tendency, I certainly don't see it as being very helpful. I think it's rare in the world that I grew up in to explore a more creative alternative to something like Adderall or attention deficit disorder, which I think would be much healthier and really is more just a reflection of untapped potential as opposed to some sort of like deficit. Like I see all of my ADHD or whatever to be really just all creative energy that doesn't know where it wants to go.
So there's a scene in Lady Bird in which you've been Saoirse Ronan's character's boyfriend, and she thinks like you're really soulmates. And then she finds you kissing another boy, and she realizes that you're gay, and she's so angry and so like personally offended because she feels like you weren't honest with her, and also her dreams of you being her forever boyfriend are ruined. And she won't speak to you until you visit her at the cafe where she's working and you talk to her. And I want to play that scene.
What do you want from me? Yes?
My grandma wanted me to tell you that she missed you at Christmas.
Yeah, well, I couldn't have gone anyway. My mom was pissed about Thanksgiving.
Your mom is crazy. I'm scared of her.
She's not crazy. She's just... You know, she has a big heart. She's very warm.
I don't find your mother warm.
You don't?
No, well, no, she's warm, yeah, but she's also kind of scary.
Well, you can't be scary and warm.
I think you can. Your mom is.
You're gay.
Can you not tell anyone, please? I'm so sorry about everything. I'm so ashamed of all of it. It's just, it's going to be bad, and I just need a little bit of time to figure out how I'm going to tell my mom and dad and...
Don't worry. I won't tell. It's okay.
So, Lucas Hedges, at the end of that scene, you are sobbing in her arms. Did Saoirse Ronan know that you were going to be sobbing, or did you surprise her with that?
Yeah, I didn't know either that I would. And if you watch the movie, that's a wide shot that it happens in. I think it was the second take, and I felt compelled in that direction, and I did it. It didn't feel right to do it again, and it wasn't there for the rest of that scene, which is why it's in the wide. It felt like it had been building up in me before we had started filming, and then that was the only take it came out on.
I thought that was so effective because she's so disarmed by it. I mean, you are in such emotional distress at that point that how can she be angry at you? I mean, you're going through such inner turmoil about your own feelings, and then you're good friends. You're not sexual with each other after that, but you remain... You become very close again. It's just the terms of the closeness have changed. So
yeah.
I thought that was incredibly effective.
Oh, thank you.
Your father is a screenwriter and playwright and director, and as we've said, he wrote and directed the new movie that you star in, Ben Is Back. So growing up with a father who was in the movie and theater world, did you meet a lot of actors? And did their work seem interesting to you?
Yeah, I remember one time when my dad was doing Dan in real life, I got to choose whether or not to go.
That was a 2007 movie with Steve Carell. It was a couple of years after he left The Daily Show while he was still in the office.
Exactly. And I had the choice of as to whether or not I would I could go play paintball with my brother and his friends, or go bowling with Juliette Binoche and some people from the movie. And at that time, I remember it was like to go play paintball was like it was like a sacred thing in for a boy my age. It was like like if you played paintball, you could talk about it for the whole week with kids. And I much preferred the idea of going bowling and getting to talk to Juliette Binoche, because there was something about, I was always really just obsessed with actors and of what their lives were like, and I just wanted to know them. I didn't watch movies and I didn't go, wow, I wish I could do that scene or I wish I could play that character. I went, I want to be a part of this process in some way. There's a magic involved in filmmaking that I got to witness through my dad's movies. And I had this obsession with actors in particular.
So that meant that you also spent a lot of time with adults.
Yeah. Whenever my dad was making a movie, like when my dad did The Odd Life of Timothy Green and I was in eighth grade, I went and visited him for a week, and I'd get up at 6 a.m. with him, and I would sit on set the entire day, and it was the most exciting thing in the world for me. I'd just eat double bubble and watch the monitor. And it was like, I remember everyone was like, why are you here at 6 a.m? And I just want, there's nothing I wanted more than to be on set.
Because you've played gay characters in a couple of movies, in Lady Bird and in one of your current movies, Boy Erased, I think a lot of people have been asking you, like, how do you identify? And in one interview, you said that you see yourself as a spectrum, you know, as being on the spectrum, someplace between gay and straight. And that the first time the idea of there being a kind of sexual orientation spectrum, or, you know, was when you were in sixth grade, like a health teacher brought that up. And I was thinking, as somebody, you know, considerably older than you, I was thinking, how amazing that must be in sixth grade to have somebody tell you that, not only tell you that there was such a thing as a spectrum, but to say that in a non-judgmental way, like it's okay to position yourself wherever you want to on that spectrum. Was it like a remarkable, like, what did you make of that in sixth grade? And was it remarkable to you that somebody was saying that? Or within your family, was that just a kind of like a given that, of course there is?
Well, I was aware at the time that the world I was raised in was rare, that I was lucky. I'd won the lottery to be going to this school in Brooklyn Heights, and that I was aware that I came from a family that was well off. But it also came with, you know, my school did also struggle with the same things that I think most everywhere struggles with. You know, there wasn't a single out gay kid in my class, even though we were supposedly enlightened, you know. And I didn't feel as though it would be safe for me to live openly as whatever it is I identified as. In that moment, I wasn't like, now I can express myself freely. I registered it and went, I think that's true, and I know I'm not 100% straight. And I think that that's also in keeping with what's happening in the world right now, is that things really aren't black and white, particularly with my generation and the ones that are coming up after me. That's sort of where the needle's being pushed forward, is it's not just like, we can't be easily boxed in one definition.
Did you find it reassuring that there was the concept of a spectrum and that it was okay to be wherever you were on that spectrum? To have a teacher tell you that?
Yeah.
Even though you didn't feel like you could talk about it with other people yet, still.
somebody told you, an authority figure told you, it's okay.
My parents told me from a young age that I remember them sitting down and saying, listen, just so you know, if you're gay, that is more than okay. And my godfather, I remember, and lots of the most important people in my life are gay. And so I felt as though that reassurance was there, and what was offered to me in that moment was nuance and a sense of, oh, okay, it's not black and white, and there aren't just gay people and straight people. Yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you how you identify, because that's your business, and if you want to say something, you're welcome to, but I'm not going to ask you about it unless you want to speak about it. But what I will ask you is it awkward for you as a young man who is, you know, figuring out your identity as an adult in the world to be asked questions like that?
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes I feel as though I have to kind of figure things out on the fly and in front of the world in a way that makes me feel a little anxious. And it's tricky, too, because the way that I do feel isn't easily defined. So it's not like I can just throw a word out. It typically comes with a few sentences. I also don't feel as though it is my job to share when not asked. And I also sometimes feel pressure to, when I'm asked, be specific. And that also doesn't feel appropriate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's a whole, it's sort of a,
okay.
it can get, yeah, it's awkward. Yeah.
Yeah. So are you looking forward to doing roles when you're not the son or the grandson, but you're an independent adult who isn't living with parents?
Yeah, I think so. At the same time, right now I feel like I'm missing out on something a bit. I feel like I've done maybe I've worked enough in the last 2 years that I feel like I want to maybe get a few hobbies and live a little more so that when the day does come for me to play an independent person who's not a son, that I'll be ready. And not only that, I will actually be independent.
Well, Lucas Hedges, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your performances.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. I really, really appreciate you and this conversation.
Lucas Hedges stars in two new movies, Boy Erased, for which he was nominated for a Golden Globe, and Ben is Back. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.